Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches, especially today. This is episode 388, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is Jason Heaton, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, James Stacey. James, it's Monday this week that we're recording. Are you feeling fresh, or are you feeling kind of burned out?
Oh, I'm feeling pretty fuzzy. I'm feeling pretty fuzzy. I had kind of a slower paced weekend at the cottage. It was rainy, so we just kind of laid about and didn't really get up to a ton. I got home and just, you know, one of those weeks where you just go, I'm definitely not ready for what this week will entail.
Yeah.
I'm just having one of those. I'm heading to New York early tomorrow morning, and I'll be there till Friday. Of course, it's the end of the month, so we have the Hodinkee happy hour, which I'm really pumped about. But my usual partner in crime for those, Tim Jeffries, it's August. He's on vacation before Geneva Watch Days, so I'm flying solo for that. And so I got to figure out a way to – I might have to recruit somebody else from the Hodinkee office to help me lug, I don't know, about 250 pounds worth of beer a couple blocks over. It's always a very weird Uber to order. I need the biggest Uber possible, and we're going like about 800 meters.
Oh my gosh.
And so it's always a lot if you're trying to get them into the back of like a Tahoe where the kind of load height's kind of high.
Yeah.
Other than that, it should be great. Always looking forward to a little trip into town. It's kind of cool here this week. But it looks to be wicked hot in the city. So, I have to pack for that. And then I have a little. It's not something I think is time to talk about today. But I have a little side quest happening on Friday to go look at a possibly dumb purchase. And and so
maybe next week. Well, yeah,
yeah. So that's kind of the scene. But yeah, heading down to the city and looking forward to it. How's your last week been? Lots of continued shuffling of things, both from one house to another and from one house to the great beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. Rainy weekend at a cottage, just chilling out. Sounds awfully appealing right about now, because I'm definitely tired of moving house. It's been a slow motion process. I mean, I've been doing it for the past several months, but I've got someone who's going to be renting my old house starting this coming weekend. And now it's getting down to the wire, and I really need to get every last bit out of that place. And, you know, I'm just cursing myself as I, you know, dig into yet another drawer or a box in the back of a closet that's been there since 2004. And I just think, why did I keep that? Why did I buy that? Why do I need 15 pillows? Why did we save all these candle holders or, you know, whatever? Why did we need so
much? Why do I have so many light bulbs?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just... I think my mother used to give a lot of hand-me-down sort of pillows and bedding. And I kind of have this joke now that old house was like insulated with bedding, because it's just, you know, quilts sure. and comforters and pillows and stuffed into every closet. So it's a lot of that sort of thing. And then I've got a service coming to clean the place midweek this week. And yeah, we had some family visiting, you know, over the past week, and that kind of kept us busy. And then to top things off, I'm doing a very abbreviated 24-hour, or actually it's less than 24-hour trip to Chicago midweek this week. So it's kind of an unusual little side trip down there that's kind of throwing a little wrinkle in the middle of the week. But, you know, other than that, it's things are going well. The days are getting a little shorter. And like you said, in the Toronto area, it's definitely been cooler here, which makes for good sleeping. And I went for a run early this morning, which felt good. So all in all, things are going fine. Yeah, and we've got a very watch heavy episode.
We do, yeah. And but let's get to the news, or the you know, the what do we call it, housekeeping or whatever. First up, we've got the Toronto Timepiece Show coming up. We are now essentially a month away. September 26th and 27th are the main 2 days. And on the 26th, we will be doing a live show event from the show itself. And then I'm actually working on setting up a gear swap with the folks from RZE. I had a good call with Huey the other day, putting some plans together for that. So that would give us something to do to go get a bite to eat and trade gear.
Oh, nice.
Whatever you've got that maybe you don't need anymore, but somebody else might find value in. Jason, I'm not sure how much you can bring up. Maybe a full suitcase of stuff, given your current scenario. But yeah. We should be able to. We're just looking for a spot to host 30 or so people. To do the gear swap. So that should come together, and I'll have all those details on the Slack as soon as it's locked in. And then in the evening, we'll have the marathon party. It'll start sometime after normal dinner hours, you know, 7 or so. But that RSVP will come out in the next week and have all the details. We should have room for pretty much anybody who would like to attend. And certainly if you have any issues with that, once the RSVP's out, just let us know. I'm very excited for that. And we have a very cool sort of evolution in the plan. This year, you know, I think I mentioned on a previous show that I wanted to switch up what beer we were carrying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I've gotten more and more into the craft beer, I kind of like Collective Arts less and less, especially when it comes to their IPAs. They're very heavy,
mm-hmm.
and I'm enjoying some of the lighter, you know, hazier stuff, which I know isn't everybody's taste. I also wanted to expand into, you know, more lagers, more pilsners, essentially stuff I've learned from doing these happy hours.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, my taste is not the average taste in beer. Not everybody wants it to be a meal or, you know, kind of a very sort of dank experience.
Yeah.
So I reached out to our buddy Beer Nye at Fatheads Brewery, and he's working on figuring out how to get enough beer for everybody up from there. We had this beer on the boat after the dive in Chicago for Wind Up in a Lake. And I mean, again, as a fan of Hazy's, the Hazy's excellent, but all the beer is great from them. So that's something I'm very excited about. We're just locking in those details. So really hoping that all works out in the future, but we'll have great beer, great food. If you remember last year and you were hooked on the donuts like me, I maybe eat donuts once a year. And this would be a good option. Martin assured me that they will have the donuts again. So it's going to be a great evening, one that we're all looking forward to. And then the other thing to talk about would be our Strap Habit TGN10 Dazzle Camo Strap is back in stock. So a couple months ago, we did a special strap for the 10th anniversary of the show. It's a $35, pretty straightforward nylon NATO style strap. But it has our Dazzle camo, the sort of orange and tan camo pattern, an amazing design of that pattern from our friends and helpful designers at Staycom Industries. It has a cool sort of Easter egg if you flip the strap over, where you get a little bit of text kind of built into the patterning of the NATO. And yeah, so it sold out immediately. We thought we had enough. We even added extra at some point, and it still sold out like in minutes. So this is now the restock. I believe everybody who had signed up for notifications of restock has had a chance, and now it's just available on Strap Habit's website. So a big shout out to Nick from Strap Habit for being a great partner on that. And if you'd like to pick out a really fun, kind of wild, expressive NATO, I think it works best on like your most demure, stoic, black dial sport watches, yeah. That sort of thing. But I've seen some great combos on the Slack, and I've really been enjoying wearing mine. Nice quality, simple strap, fair price, all that kind of stuff. So a nice way to celebrate the 10th anniversary.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, speaking of watches and straps, let's do a wrist check before we dive into more watch talk. What are you wearing?
I had to give a little bit of love to the Seiko Monster after last week's episode. It was feeling pretty down. If felt a little beat up by a couple of the strays that it caught in our episode about great watches that we don't like. Which is what we drafted in last week's episode. Some really hilarious conversations on Slack over that. People listing essentially all sorts of watches that I love, or Jason, maybe that you love too, that they hate. I sometimes you wonder how we all managed to get onto one digital platform together with such disparate tastes.
Yeah, the aerospace took some heat. I saw a thread there. Yeah.
The aerospace took some heat for sure. Annie Digi in general, yeah. Doxa. Took some heat as well, which of course I don't get any of that. I'm on the opposite side of that line for sure. So I figured I'd throw on the Monster. I've got it on the bracelet and I still dig it. I thought maybe I'd put it on and you would have talked me out of it to a certain extent. But I really like it. I think I might take it down to New York with me. It's a fun kind of compliment for the 200T Army, which has the sort of orange element as well. I think I'll at least wear it for the day and see how it feels like. With this, you know, we talked about this in the past, that it's a watch that I enjoy, but I don't always enjoy wearing it for more than a short period of time because of the bracelet. But I'm going to give it another run, and maybe that'll be my watch for the week. You know, I don't often, well, I guess I do often because I get to go to New York, but New York's one of the rare scenarios where I travel without changing time zones, so I can take any watch that I'd like.
Oh, sure.
Which is a good one. But yeah, how about you? What have you got on wrist this week? Because I know you don't have anything more to say about the Monster.
I do not. No, I'll hold my tongue this week. That was last week's rant. I pulled out something I haven't worn in a while. It's the Elliot Brown, the Holton GMT Auto. As I'm, you know, in the middle of moving and everything, my watches have kind of taken a back seat. I've just been kind of wearing the same stuff week in and week out. And I opened the watch box, I guess yesterday, and pulled out the Holton. It had been a while. And it's striking, though, after wearing, you know, titanium stuff like the FXD and whatever to put on this watch, which is really a hefty piece. I mean, it's an automatic. Mechanicals tend to weigh more anyway, but then it's a big steel-cased watch. And I've got it on the rubber that came with it. I mean, Elliott Brown does a nice job with their rubber straps, and it's a very handsome watch. But boy, it's a brick. I mean, it's a hefty thing. So adds to my, you know, like you with the hauling the beer, you know, hauling stuff to Goodwill and loading up the back of the Defender with stuff to move. I don't know that I need the extra ounces on my wrist, so it might get swapped out later today.
I definitely need the exercise, so I'll keep the full steel effect of the Monster on wrist. But yeah, I agree. After wearing the Doxa, which is just a small watch,
yeah,
in steel on a like a nylon two piece sort of strap, and or you know any one of my titanium's really become the kind of cornerstone of what I wear, and switching back to a steel watch, a steel dive watch on a solid steel bracelet is super noticeable.
Yeah, we get spoiled, don't we? I mean,
I love titanium.
Yeah, I do too. And I never, I don't know, for years I was kind of neutral on it, but I wear it more often than not these days.
I'd have to go back and double check, and it'd be like going back and double checking on my own stupid lore, but I think like the Pelagos 39 kind of changed it for me. It's like I hit a zone where that's what I liked, and I started trying to seek it out in other formats like the aerospace, like the CWN1, and that sort of thing. So
yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, that's a couple of watches already crossed off the list. But really what we're here to talk about today is new watches. We're in essentially the start of like the second phase of the annual calendar of new watches. You know, we start to see new stuff in as early as January. And then, of course, March, April is full of new watches leading up to Watches and Wonders. And then in the start, you know, end of the summer, very start of the sort of fall season, we kick everything off with releases around and in Geneva Watch Days. So that's kind of what we're starting with here, is kind of the wave of watches coming out just before Geneva Watch Days kicks off in very early September. Jason, anywhere where you feel really like, let's start on a high note, something we're kind of pumped about, anything you like from this list?
Why don't you get us started on this Albashorn Marinograph Classic, which it's just one of those things like a L'Aventure or, you know, these kind of brands that we don't talk about a lot, but I just feel like they're right in our wheelhouse. And this one is so cool.
Yeah, Albashorn's one of these brands that I kind of knew about because we cover them. But as guys like Mark Kozlerich and Tantan Wang, my colleagues at Hodinkee, have such sort of a fandom for them, they really appreciate the watch. They're made in very limited quantities. Often their pieces are less than 100 in an edition. Mm-hmm. So they made one called the Marinograph Classic Racing, which was sort of a take on a regatta timer.
Yeah.
This is essentially just a new sort of evolution of that. It's not a huge change. But I like the styling better here than on the racing version. This is just the Marinograph Classic. And I think these look really good. They're 39 millimeter steel monopusher chronograph regatta timers that have sort of, it's a Blancpain 50 fathom, like a classic 50 fathom style bezel, mm-hmm. I guess is sort of at least the footing of that design. And then the dial, I think, is harder to describe, as are the hands.
Yeah.
Nothing really looks like this watch. I guess another Albashorn might, which is, like you said, kind of the L'Aventure thing, which is quite impressive. They're using essentially a heavy modification of a 7750 architecture. But of course, you have a mono pusher and much more power reserve. I think it's 64 hours. Yeah, 64 hours. And then you have both the crown and the pusher are on the left side of the case. So away from your wrist, and especially for the pusher, because that's where my thumb would fall if I pinched the watch. I always kind of like that, you know, if you grab the watch, you kind of hit at 9 with your thumb and at like 2 o'clock with your index.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense, especially on a mono pusher where you could just have everything right there with your thumb.
Yeah.
And I mostly put this on for you because I know you're very much a regatta timer sort of guy. And I think that this kind of lands in a zone that's very interesting, but doesn't really depart so far from any one element of the classics that it loses the plot, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Which dial color do you like? There's a white and a black dial.
Yeah, I'm the black, drawn
to
I think.
I'm drawn to the white.
Okay, cool.
I'd skip the red rubber strap that they show it on. I'm not much of a color strap guy, but this is such a dynamic watch. This is a watch that if I was kind of in acquisition mode these days, I would make a pretty hard run for this because I just think it's such a cool piece.
Not really anything quite like it.
Yeah, and I love the that style of pusher. Everything is just done a little bit differently, and I've just come to really kind of appreciate that with something like the Doxa Army, the 200 that you've got that we've talked about, and just a little bit left of center with some of these. Yeah, a little bit of quirk. The pusher, it's got a running seconds or kind of a running indicator in kind of a small aperture on the right side of the dial, and then those funky cardinal markers, and even the hand shape. I mean, it's just that combined with the, I'm a sucker for a Blancpain style, kind of 50 fathom style, that sort of domed sapphire bezel. I don't know. I have nothing bad to say about this watch. I think it's beautiful, and it's, hard to get, I'm sure, because it's such low quantity, but it's reasonably priced, under 4,000 looks like. So, good stuff.
Yes, $4,000. They're making 99 of each colorway, so there's under 200 out there. And I know that this went on sale, like, by the time you're listening to this, more than almost 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what availability will be like, but this feels like a brand, like you said, like LaVenture, which is just like should be on your radar. Mm-hmm. It's that late. Maybe this is a silly thing to say, but it feels like even a fourth generation of what we would remember as like a micro brand.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about a heavily modified sort of proprietary movement, mono pusher functionality, interesting pushers, just like very little that feels like they're going, oh, we're making an expression of this type of watch, but for the sub $1,000 crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's not a cheap watch. Certainly, actually very, very little on this list is that we're chatting about today. This is, starts under 4,000 Swiss francs, but definitely at least one to have on your radar. And kudos to Albashorn for just kind of consistently making interesting things that it make me want to click in and read about them.
Yeah, definitely. Why don't we, since we mentioned Blancpain, not that it's exactly the same, but in looks or anything, they released this 70th anniversary limited edition bathyscaphe in, I think it's just about 300 pieces. So it's, who knows, they're probably all gone by now, but is an interesting watch as well.
Yeah, I think this watch was meant, like, I think this is the sort of watch that people do want in many ways from Blancpain, in 2026, the pricing, there's always some sticker shock, I think.
Yeah.
And this is $18,300 dive watch that looks, let's just call balls and strikes, it looks a lot like a Seiko Diver from the 62 Mass. And this is based on a design from 65. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's where it took a lot of heat, is people saying, like, whether it's an SPB, a 143, a 453, or up into the SLA stuff, this watch doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And you're certainly... you need to want that absolute highest level execution to go after something like this, where you're sure it's 37.4 millimeters, it's 12.3 millimeters thick. We're big Blancpain fans. I think it's a gorgeous watch, but I also think the Seikos are gorgeous, so this isn't surprising at all. I think that's, I wouldn't say there was controversy. I just saw lots of sort of folks teasing that. I mean, like, this feels like an exceptionally conventional sort of watch for today's like faux vintage expression of watches, so much so that it almost doesn't feel like special enough to be a Blancpain.
I can see that perspective, and I did see some of those comments about it looking like a 62 Mass Seiko, and I guess if you want it,
which isn't a bad thing, and it's just there's a huge delta in price.
And even if you go with kind of a Grand Seiko or kind of the SLA, it's kind of high end kind of Seiko divers that play on this design or this kind of heritage, it's still a definite jump in price up to $18,300. But it does bring to mind the kind of the whole argument about what makes a watch worth a certain price. And this one certainly has brand prestige and of course the finishing and the movement quality and whatever. But is it is it that much more than a Grand Seiko diver? I'm not sure. I think this is, it's such a subjective thing. And I think if I consider my own bathyscaphe, the Hodinkee limited edition from several years ago, you know, 6-7 years ago, you look at that watch and it's a little 38 millimeter watch that looks incredibly conventional. I mean, it looks kind of like to the average person, you know, on an airplane or at the Starbucks or something like that. If they saw that on my wrist, they'd be like, you know, oh, this guy's wearing like a cheap old dive watch or whatever, you know, just kind of looks whatever. And it's probably, you know, a topic for an article or a whole separate episode, but like why is a watch like that worth what it is? Or why is this one worth what it is? But that's for a different episode. But
yeah, I think it's a mix of price and category. It's a limited edition. Yeah. You can look at the history of their other LEs that they've done for 50 fathoms, one of which got you and I out to an island, a penal colony of some sort off of Khan a few years back. But yeah, I think this is an absolutely gorgeous watch, and you know it's going to be incredibly well made, and with Blancpain you're paying for finishing that you don't even see, like both sides of the movement and all these sorts of things. I just think that in a world where this watch looks so much and is so similar in many ways to a much less expensive watch that is beloved, mm-hmm. it just puts you in a bad stead. That said, with 300 pieces, I think that a lot of the audience, myself included on the stuff I've just said, a lot of the audience that has that feedback isn't necessarily part of the buying audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's two different things.
Yeah.
So while there's feedback there that could be valuable, this is an LE. It represents a blip on the radar, not a core model or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think it looks great. I would love to see one in person, certainly before I had any sort of final thoughts. Awesome looking thing. And Blancpain's 50 fathoms have never been cheap watches. So while I think it's a lot of money for the watch, it's also not a lot of surprise. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Should we stick with dive watches and move to the Doxa, the Frogger?
Yeah, sure. So this is a new Doxa LE, and obviously Hodinkee just did an LE with Doxa, so I like these things, I enjoy them. And it's kind of an unexpected one, and maybe the first time that this format is starting to work for my dumb tastes. This is called the Frogger. It's made with Belmont Watches in San Diego. It's like a retailer special edition. It's 100 pieces, and it's based on the Beta, which is like a sort of modern, more design-forward expression of a 300T or a 300. So it's a 42.5 millimeter steel case. These retail or will retail. These go. These will be have launched a day or two before this episode comes out. And they're retailing for about $28.90, including a bracelet. And they've basically taken the normal Beta and removed a lot of the shine. It has sort of a textured green dial, a lot of orange accent, yeah. Very minimal text where it kind of just says Doxa on the dial. And I think in many ways this is kind of like the Beta pushing toward almost like a Pelagos aesthetic, mm-hmm. where it's a little bit stripped back. Obviously, the Pelagos not known for its light use of text. but in this case, it just says Doxa. I like the orange accents. I enjoy the green. And for me, this is the first Beta that didn't feel kind of too shiny or too sort of, you know, detailed in its design, like it just stripped back a little bit. And I think it works pretty well for it.
Yeah, I would agree. And one thing I'm particularly like about it, although I'm not sure I'd like it day in and day out, but is the, you really get a sense of the bezel kind of shape, the kind of sawtooth dynamic of that bezel when it's in that sort of dark color against the lighter color case kind of behind it. I think that's kind of neat, because I mean that bezel is Doxa's calling card, and the texture dial is really cool. The Beta has never been one that I've been drawn to. I always just kind of pass it over, but this one does make me kind of linger a little bit. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, and it's all matte, like it's all a bead blasted finish. It's meant to be connected Frogger, I think, to Frogmen, to a military aesthetic, that sort of thing. Hence, whether or not that part speaks to you is up to you, of course. I think the watch works as well as any Beta I've come across. And this is another one where, and I'm sure at some point in the future at a TGN thing or a Hodinkee happy hour, I'll get to see one in person. I think these will be quite niche and kind of remembered fondly down the road as far as an LE. So kudos to Belmont. Doxa does a handful of these ones with retailers. I guess Hodinkee via Watches of Switzerland isn't that different. That really do kind of maintain interesting small footprint, whether obviously the, I think the banner ones would be the Topper Ellies, mm-hmm. you know, the three generations of the Great Whites.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to have that lineage, but it's a nice way for them to explore something that really changes up the format. And maybe it's the dial with no additional embellishment that I like the most.
Mm-hmm.
But I do really like that the full orange coloring and markings on the bezel, on the elapsed time element of the two scale bezel.
Yeah. Nicely done.
Where do you want to go next? What are you feeling?
Let's take a big turn here and tell us about this Ming Comet, because this is
this is the one I'm excited about.
To me this morning, and it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, so this will have come out yesterday by the time the show drops. It is timed for August 26th, and this is the Ming 5705 Comet. It's named after the de Havilland Comet, which was the first commercial jet airliner, and it is a 40 millimeter steel world time Ming, and I think it's just exceptionally cool. So you have a kind of a Sellita based movement with Ming finishing that gives you jumping hour set for the world time ring. That's pretty standard for a world timer. It's one of the things you would need. But the trick here is you have a very wide, almost like Cartier style, if you go back to early Patek world timers, that had these quite large bezels to make room for all of the cities. But they've built in a little trick where it's actually not all one bezel. It's a ring around the crystal and dial that is fixed with cities that don't observe DST.
Mm-hmm.
And then the outer ring can be adjusted one click, 1 hour, and has a little aperture. So when you click it into DST mode, all of the cities that observe DST move forward an hour. And then you also have a little flag. So a little color goes from DST on or off. So if it's off, there's no red. And then if you click it on, there's red. I think this is awesome. I'm obviously a big fan of Ming. I think what they do is interesting. I definitely would like to own one at some point, and this has jumped way to the top of the list. They're doing 200 pieces. Like I said, it's 40 millimeters. It's 10.3 by 47.8. And it starts at 7,000 Swiss francs, more if you want to order it with a poly mesh. But it is steel, and the poly mesh is titanium. So that would be up to you. This is the sort of watch from Ming that makes me very excited. Doesn't look like all the stuff I'm used to. And I love the world time function. Sure, it's a few more bucks. Not a few. It's a good jump in cost from something like the Nomos world timer that I have. But it also gives you that like more classic deco-y world timer, but then with the Ming spin on it, I'm in. This is very cool.
I'm always surprised at, you know, yes, these are expensive watches, but how relatively affordable Mings are for what you get, for kind of the inventiveness and the craftsmanship. And I think this is a great example of that. And I think the functionality of this is just outside the box thinking, which is great. And I could see this maybe being applicable, you know, the thing I always wondered about for years. And we've seen one example of this, and I can't remember, you brought it up on an episode, probably another new watch episode, of a watch that showed the time zones in countries that are off by half an hour from the kind of the standard. And I don't remember what it was. It had that unusual set of hands, if I remember right. I can't remember the brand. Maybe some people will remember that one. But I could see this, you know, this potentially being used for something like that in the future. I'm not sure if Ming would want to develop something like that. But I think the thing about world timers, I'm not one that is really in the market for one or really want one. But one thing that's always appealed to me about them is it is this sort of romantic, exotic sense of travel. You know, you get all these airport codes or these city names on some of the older ones that they just kind of hearken to the age when people were just starting to travel the world, and I've always loved that about world timers. And this is a really very modern take on it, with also a very throwback element with all the city names around it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the two things I would say is, one, the watch that you mentioned with the 30-minute and 40 or 15-minute offset, 45 or 15-minute offset hand is called the Ardra Labs Delta.
There you go.
The Delta type, which is very cool. I'll include that in the show notes. Tan wrote about it back in March. And the second one is, even if this isn't necessarily a watch up your alley, the Ming, the Comet, at least hit up the story on Hodinkee. Again, it'll be in the show notes, and see the Loom. Jason, it's wow. Image 5 in that package I sent you.
All right,
and I just, it's two color Loom. It's blue and orange, depending on
Wow.
day, night.
Oh my gosh.
For the 24 hour display. And then the DST flag are in red, luminous paint, and I just think it looks really, really cool.
Wow, that is great.
So, jeez. Yeah, they just make a very neat watch, and this is something I feel like I can get excited about and would be, like I said, on my list for a hunt one down in the future sort of scenario.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, good stuff.
Well, let's stick with kind of travel watch kind of thing, and I'll talk about one that I actually had got some hands-on time with a while back before it was released, and that's the Olic & Weiss Early Bird. They're calling it the numbered edition. This is, you know, we don't talk about O&W much on the show. I do think it's kind of in the TGN wheelhouse, a lot of their stuff, because they make some kind of cool dive watches. And I remember when I was just getting into watches, kind of mechanical watches back in the early 2000s, O&W was only available through like some really old fashioned, very low tech website where you could order in the US at least. And, you know, I think it kind of goes to their long-standing tradition. It was a company founded in Zurich in the 50s, and they used to do mail order kind of sales at kind of affordable prices, and they became pretty popular with kind of military, you know, soldiers and sailors and things in the Vietnam War who would order these watches. And they developed this watch in the 60s called the Early Bird, and the Early Bird was named after a geosynchronous satellite, you know, one of the first ones to kind of orbit the Earth. And this watch kind of plays on the same idea as the Glycine Airman, in that it's a 24-hour movement with a rotating bezel that's on a 24-hour scale as well. So it can track two different time zones in 24-hour mode. So you never have to guess AM or PM. It takes, you know, those of you that know 24-hour dials know that, you know, it takes a little bit of an adjustment to kind of read properly. So if it looks like it's, 10 o'clock, it's not. It's, you know, like 2000 hours. So it's a unique piece. They didn't make very many back in the 60s. They were kind of favored by, I think, as the lore goes, you know, kind of helicopter pilots in Vietnam or whatever would wear these. O&W kind of listened to the collector community and has made a reissue version of this with a modified Soprod movement, and it's kind of based on their dive watch platform. So it's got 300 meters water resistance, which is obviously impressive and very functional and useful. It's a 39.5 millimeter case, kind of a cool watch. It comes on a bracelet, or you can get a black leather strap. And they've got they're taking orders now, but there's a delivery wait for about 4 weeks. So kind of a cool thing.
Every time that I come across an O&W in person, I'm always impressed by kind of the quality to the price point.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know, working up around $2,000 or 2,000 Swiss francs is necessarily the norm in their current. But in the past, the stuff I've seen from a lower price point, or in some cases a higher, I thought looked pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a nice piece. And when I had it, I enjoyed wearing it. The one thing I wasn't that keen on was the bracelet that it came on. It was sort of this multi-link bracelet. Just felt a little fancier than what I wanted for the watch. But you know, watches or straps and bracelets are easy enough to swap around. So, and the price USD, they've got it listed in Swiss francs, but you can adjust for USD, and it's a 2443 USD. So not a cheap piece, but, definitely something unique that you won't see on many wrists.
Yeah. There aren't many out there doing the 24 hour thing.
Yeah.
Glycine, Aeronautic, if you remember the Mitch from Ocean 7 back in the day.
Wow, there you go.
He also had Aeronautic. I had one of those watches I think back in the Watch Report days, in for review. And again, like I think we've talked about before, the 24 hour thing is exceptionally strange until you spend some time with it.
Yeah.
And then it just makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because you start seeing the day as a whole rather than two halves.
Yeah.
And I think it makes sense. It's a cool way to get around it. And I understand why it's not common, because, I mean, even the act of knowing how to tell time is becoming less common in the analog sense.
Mm-hmm.
On watches. So, you know, I guess this didn't necessarily survive the pre-quartz, you know, aerospace and digital watches and all that kind of stuff. Looking back into the kind of classic aviation, I think it's kind of a neat thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You want to do this cool Smith's Lost Diver, and then we can we can close it out with a new, smaller option from Omega?
Yeah, this isn't actually a new watch. It's actually a very old watch, and it was actually just a one-off. But it's a story that kind of has surfaced recently, thanks to Christopher Herbert, who owns a really cool retailer slash website called Finest Hour Timepieces. Some people might have heard of that. Sells distinctly and specifically vintage British and German military watches from World War II and on. And Christopher wrote to me and said, you know, this might be up your alley, and certainly is. He wrote a story called The Smiths That Never Was, Britain's Lost Military Diver, and it's going to be published in Timepiece, which is the magazine of the British Watch and Clockmakers Guild. And it's about, you know, Smiths was the what commonly people refer to as the last kind of fully British watch manufacturer. So they I think they went out of business in 70 or 71. They, for many, many years, they were making watches, you know, that were worn on Everest with, you know, Edmund Hillary in the 50s, and, you know, British military pieces, famously, you know, a W10 kind of army watch.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in the mid-60s, they were commissioned by the Ministry of Defense to look into the development of a diving watch. And so they did. They took their W10, which was their standard army watch with the movement, hand-wound movement, and put it in a beefier case and did some tests on it. It's a 42 millimeter case. It's definitely beefier looking. If you look at it, the only known prototype doesn't even have a rotating bezel, but Christopher kind of superimposed sort of a digitally created dive bezel to see what it would look like. It's kind of funny to see a Smith style in kind of this beefy case with fixed lugs and kind of that classic old-timey Smith's mid-century military dial on it. And this was actually put through some testing by the Royal Navy's Admiralty Experimental Diving Unit and never came to fruition. So it's kind of one of those what-if or what-might-have-been stories. You know, we think about the Mil Sub and the Seamaster 300s that were issued in the 60s and 70s. And if Smiths had kind of continued in business, maybe this would have been the replacement for the Mil Sub instead of waiting till 1980 with CWC. So just a cool story I wanted to bring to people's attention, and we can throw a link to some stories here, and you can read a little bit more, and also to check out Finest Hour. They aren't selling this watch by any means, but it's just a cool website in general.
Yeah, definitely a cool thing, and a neat piece of what do they call it? Sliding doors.
Yeah,
where you know what could have been wasn't, but they made it. You have to wonder, especially with a lot of these British brands, or in some ways, I always wonder what's in the drawer from a lot of major Swiss brands from like 1970 that they were working on in like 1972 to 1977.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
when quartz really caused everybody to change course.
Yeah.
We were just kind of working our way into an integrated bracelet sport watch, and then hit this wall, this like sea change with quartz. And I just wonder what's sitting in some spots.
Yeah.
that has kind of left, or in this case, you know, they made one watch with the hopes that it would be something, you know, kind of longstanding and made in probably into the thousands.
Yeah.
And you know, just things didn't work out. It's an interesting piece for sure. So a big thanks to them for sending that in.
Yeah. All right. Let's close it out with an Omega.
Yeah. So not to bury the lead, one of the bigger watches announced this week, just a couple days ago, is the new Speedmaster 38. And, you know, not necessarily the sort of watch we would always cover. I think since the Speedmaster 38 kind of picked up where the Reduced had left off, but I think it was the better part of a decade between the end of the Reduced and the start of the Speedmaster 38. It's always been a little bit fancier, a little bit more, you know, likely to have a diamond bezel or something like that. And I think a little bit more tuned towards Omega's generalist female audience.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not their enthusiast female audience, but I thought this one was worth highlighting. One, because it's the latest evolution, and I think that they are moving, it's evolving back towards the Moonwatch.
Mm-hmm.
The standard Speedmaster, which I think is a good thing. You know, the oval dials are now back to being more circular. You have options with a date and without. It's starting at about $6,500, and it's 38 millimeters. It's a little under 15 millimeters thick. It should be a nice wearing watch. This is another one that I would love to see. And you know, we're working on this at Hodinkee, but I'm excited to see a photo of it next to like a standard modern Speedmaster.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I always kind of get pumped when I see somebody wearing a Reduced, because mm-hmm. they're strange, but they're strange in kind of the right way, where they are that much more wearable then, you know, the Speedy's 42 millimeters, which today is considered kind of on the start of a larger watch.
Yeah.
And I think it wears every millimeter of that. It doesn't hide any of it. You know, obviously a hugely iconic watch that is beloved by the vast core of both watch buyers and watch enthusiasts, and you know, and the overlap between the two. But yeah, that's the new 38. Jason, did you ever have a reduced? I don't remember you having one.
No, I've only had the pro, you know, vintage professionals, and I think, you know, I've come to the realization that I'll never have another. I've kind of had my time, and they just didn't stick. But there's something about this one that is appealing to me, because I think it moves you away from all the heavy weight of history, and you know, this idea that this is the moon watch, and kind of takes it back to a really wearable, like 38 millimeters, and you get 100 meters water resistance, which, you know, the Speedmaster Pro has just never been, you know, it's always been its Achilles heel, is this idea that it's just not, you can't wear it around water. And this one you could, and it's just kind of takes it back to sort of more of a generalist, great chronograph, you know, whether it's a kind of a motorsports chronograph, like it began its history as, and it's a nice looking piece. I think it's, definitely a step in the right direction for them.
Yeah, I think there's seven new versions, and for you and I, Jason, I think it's the black dial on the bracelet, like the Speedmaster looking one.
Yeah.
A lot of the other ones get into you know, other dials and diamonds and that sort of thing, which is, you know, par for the course with the 38. But yeah, I think there's definitely a cult following for the reduced. It's kind of like the cult following for the mini sub.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the smaller Tudor subs. And I think it's out there, and you see them on enthusiasts, and I think those are watches that are largely cared for now by like pretty hardcore enthusiasts about Omega and about the Speedy, but wanting something that's just that much more wearable, or a little bit less common, a little bit more interesting, that sort of thing. So, you know, time will tell if this watch appeals to that audience at all. I like that they are maintaining, I think it's the base model of this watch is within a couple hundred dollars of the current, you know, of the base model of the previous generation.
Mm-hmm.
So not a huge jump in price, which I think is good. In 2026, we'd like to see these things stabilize. We'll yet to be seen how it's kind of received by the greater audience. I don't think it's like a groundbreaking change in any way, but it is, I think, a strong evolution, especially for that core black dial option.
Yeah, and actually, as you mentioned that, I've just kind of scrolled down to the very last page of the press release, and there's a blue bezel white dial version with date that really appeals to me. And I think it's kind of going back to what I said earlier. It's like, it's such a departure from the Speedmaster Pro Moonwatch that, that might be the one. I mean, if I were in the market or shopping these, I think that I'd probably go that direction just because it is so different and yet similar kind of design codes, but just different enough that it would stand out.
Yeah. New Speedy. Going to keep people interested. Good time of year for them to launch something. So I think that's a good collection of a handful of new watches that have kind of caught our attention in the last couple of days, last couple of weeks. And then we're right on the edge of Geneva Watch Days. So there'll be another sort of look at all these cool watches from Geneva Watch Days sort of stuff. There's actually some things I'm very excited about, assuming that the pricing details we've gotten are real. There's some stuff that's significantly less money than we were kind of expecting. So excited to see some of that come out, but, some pretty solid watches from big brands and smaller brands, you know, a range of price points, all kind of more on the higher end for the sort of TGN realm. But, I wonder if they'll make some sort of a tribute version of that Lost Diver, the Smiths.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be cool. I apparently in the story, Time Factors had caught wind of this years ago and had made had some ideas for making a newer version of it. Sadly, Eddie Platz, the founder of Time Factors, passed away a few months ago, and we'll see what happens with that. But it's definitely an interesting thing. And as I look down this list, other than the Doxa, everything, as far as I can tell, is less than 40 millimeters or 40 millimeters or less, which is something. You know, I think we're kind of in that space nowadays with the watches being more reasonably sized.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree there. It's interesting to see some of the trending in terms of sizing. Lots of stuff in that 38, 39 as brands kind of catch up with that popular wave. But you want to jump into some final notes, put a bow on the show?
Yeah, sure. I have one that...
Yours looks so cool.
I don't have hands-on with this yet. This feels like one of these... This feels like a watch release, actually, because I'm really excited about it, and I did pre-order it. This is a company that I've been following on Instagram that I just find fascinating, and I finally bit the bullet and placed an order because this product in particular looks really, really cool. It is a company that people might have heard of called Craig Hill. I believe it's someone's last name. And it's this product is called the Metrolog Ruler. It's $98 pre-order. It's due to be shipped sometime in September. And it is a combination ruler and caliper made of aluminum. The only downside, I think, is, and maybe this isn't that big of a deal, but it goes up to 8 inches instead of a full foot. But what's cool about it is that it incorporates a caliper within the same, you know, form factor as the ruler in a very clever way that's sort of nested in the ruler itself, so that you just kind of slide the ruler up and down, and then it has imperial measurements on one side, and you flip it over, and the equivalent metric is on the opposite side. So if you want to know what 4 1/8 of an inch is, you just flip it over, and there's your immediate reading in terms of the caliper. And it's just, it's got this kind of dimpled texture. It has a small kind of colored dot that indicates kind of the point on the measurement for the caliper. I mean, it's just a beautifully designed product, and I can't wait to get my hands on it. It's made of anodized aluminum and all CNC milled increments, so it's very tactile, or I imagine it will be. I don't know. It just looks great, and I think I would encourage people to. And I apologize in advance, because if you do start to follow them on Instagram, you will get inundated with lots of videos and kind of teaser ads and stuff from them. But the guy who founded the company does some great explanations of all of their products. They make a really cool kind of lighter. They make kind of knickknacks for the desk, useful objects. But this one really stood out, and I can't wait to get it. So I'll do a hands-on when it actually arrives. But I thought I'd just throw this in there so people can start checking it out.
Man, this looks so cool. You may have just cost me $98 bucks. I think this looks rad. I clicked in to buy, and then I went to Apple Pay, and then I realized I was not paying attention, so I backed out. But we'll take care of that. I'm a sucker for a great caliper. Obviously, constantly kind of measuring things like watches, and now more and more often things for 3D printing. So it could be very handy to have. I love my vernier, but these would be much more travel friendly, certainly than the verniers, which do kind of look a little bit more imposing and don't fit in a bag all that well.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right, where are you at?
Yeah, mine this week is a TV show that Sarah and I just finished. It was a recommendation from my brother. Not my normal genre, but it's on Apple TV. I've seen some talk of it online, but not a ton on the Slack. So I thought maybe I'd give people the heads up if they had skipped it. It's called Widow's Bay. Mm. And I'll just read the intro from Wikipedia. Widow's Bay is an American comedy horror television series created by Katie Dippold for Apple TV and stars Matthew Rhys, Katie O'Flynn, Kevin Carroll, Dale Dickey, Kingston Rummy Southwick, and one of my favorites, Stephen Root. The series is set in a fictional New England island town of Widow's Bay, which happens to be afflicted with a centuries-old curse that brings various supernatural evils upon the island. It's awesome. Huh. It has equal parts lighthearted and very human elements, and then they play around with a lot of like horror tropes, be it both slasher and gothic and, you know, supernatural and historical horror, all wrapped up into various episodes. It is at times like laugh out loud funny. It's expressly well written. It's beautifully shot. It's very artful in its delivery. I highly recommend it. I don't know that there's anything in here that would really disappoint any. There's some bad language, you know, heads up on that, of course. I'm a huge Matthew Rhys fan, but probably best known for The Americans, which was a show I absolutely adore and highly recommend. This is great. Like I said, a little outside my genre, but really, really funny, at times a little scary, beautifully shot. And I highly recommend it if you've got Apple TV or if, I don't know, maybe you go into your phone and they're offering you 3 months. It's a very easy several episodes that you could put down in a weekend if you wanted to.
Huh, that's good. It's always good to get recommendations on shows like this, because this one I was on the fence about. I was like, this could be really good or kind of really cheesy. So it's always good to.
I think you would especially like the sort of town.
Oh, okay, nice.
Which is like kind of a beat up old fishing town.
Oh, sure.
That they're trying to turn into like a Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, okay.
And great. Matthew Rhys plays the beleaguered. Mayor.
Oh, perfect.
And then he doesn't necessarily buy into all of this curse stuff, but there's people on the island that do, and and have lived on the island for a really long time. And like, are you even allowed to leave the island if you were born there? It's great. It's really fun.
Nice.
And I'm a very easily scared type of horror fan.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked about weapons and back rooms and stuff like that in the past. That's kind of as maximum scary as I can handle before I'm uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And this never really put me in the uncomfortable space. Anytime it really leaned into the horror element, it did so in ways that still felt like a more thriller or more comedy than core horror, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's good.
And he's driving like a perfect Jeep XJ, Cherokee.
Oh, nice.
which it just looks perfect in the setting. And there's all these beautiful shots of the water. And yeah, we enjoyed it a bunch. And Sarah doesn't like horror at all and enjoyed it. So
okay, good.
There's your sign off. I think if you watched one or two episodes, you'd know exactly what you were getting into, and you could keep going if you want.
All right. Perfect. That's
it's going to be a big shout out to Steven Root. Please be in more stuff. People, please keep hiring Steven Root. But yeah. All right. Well, there you go. A whole episode in a little less than an hour. Not bad.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, as always, thanks so much. Oh, yeah. You go for it.
Yeah, 3, 2, 1. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, where you can even grab yourself a new TGN signed NATO or even just access to the great TGN Slack, please visit thegreatnato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Charles Boden, who said, "Summertime is always the best of what might be."